And Radio Derb is on the air. That was one of Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, and this is your rampantly genial host, John Derbyshire, summing up the week's events as seen from my lofty perch up here on the 95th floor of Buckley Towers in the heart of Manhattan. If listeners will forgive me indulging some personal cogitations, I have often thought that in some previous life I must have been a mandarin. Not an orange, of course, I mean a scholar official in old China. My basic outlook on world affairs is that there is a zone of civilization and a zone of barbarism. The two zones exhibit different standards and are governed by different rules. The distinction is cultural and governmental, not personal, and it's time-dependent. Elizabethan England was in many respects a very barbarous place by today's standards. The boundary line shifts with events. Stalin's Russia was certainly in the zone of barbarism. Putin's Russia, with all its faults, is not. There are limits to the boundary line's movement, though. I don't think there's any part of the world that was never barbaric, but there are certainly parts that have never been civilized. Well, this week offered some support for this viewpoint of mine. Let's take a look. MENA is mostly within the zone of barbarism. That's MENA, M-E-N-A, the shorthand term that we deep-browed geostrategic thinkers use for the Middle East and North Africa. MENA, you see. Well, at the N-A end of MENA, that would be North Africa, the barbarians have been fighting among themselves. Their chieftains haven't been delivering enough cargo, so the peasants are revolting. The latest consequence on Thursday this week was the killing of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Gaddafi had run Libya for 42 years. In fact, in that tremendous bestseller, We Are Doomed, I tabulated him as the world's longest-serving national leader, hereditary monarchs not included. The revolting peasants cornered Gaddafi at last in his hometown. Gaddafi tried to escape from his palace in a convoy, but the convoy was stopped by a NATO airstrike. Although what business it is of NATO to take sides in these tribal squabbles, I do not understand. Well, the convoy turned round and went back to the palace, and that's where Gaddafi's enemies caught up with him and punched his ticket. News of Gaddafi's death was greeted among his own people with the expressions of joy customary in that neck of the woods. Or perhaps I should say in that wadi of the desert, since Libya is not very generously endowed with woodlands. There was much wild ululation, much firing of automatic weapons into the air, not a thing you should try at home, gentle listeners, and many fervent asseverations that God is great, to which those of us unschooled in theology are bound to react by wondering, if God is so great, why he permits psychopaths like Gaddafi to rule over millions of people for decades on end. So far as we of the West are concerned, the Gaddafi story is a squalid one. We behaved badly at almost every point, the only exception being when the noble Ronald Reagan bombed Gaddafi's capital in 1986. That was retaliation for the Gaddafi-sponsored terrorist attack on a German nightclub a week earlier that had killed two US servicemen and wounded 80 others. The bombing raid, it wasn't just the capital, there were a couple of cities bombed. The bombing raid was nicely done and perfectly justified under the circumstances. It didn't change Gaddafi's behaviour, though, and he went on making a nuisance of himself to civilized nations for several years, until first UN sanctions, and then the salutary spectacle of American troops marching into Baghdad modified his attitude. He then became a fairly cooperative barbarian. Still a son of a bitch, but our son of a bitch. That's all we ask of these chieftains, and all we should ask. Just as we'd settled into this happy equilibrium, though, with Gaddafi paying compensation all around and otherwise minding his own homicidal business, his own people got fed up with him. There was a case for helping our son of a bitch at that point, and also a case, a much stronger one, in my opinion, for just sitting quiet while events ran their course. There was no case for getting involved in the squabble, but naturally, that is what our fool leaders decided to do. So, farewell then, Muammar Gaddafi. I can't say we hardly knew you. After 42 years, we knew you all too well. We didn't treat you very well. Once you decided to be our son of a bitch, we owed you at least the courtesy of not taking sides with your enemies. Still, at this stage of our civilizational decline, we are sheep led by fools, and you shouldn't have expected anything better. What will follow Gaddafi, nobody knows. Another tribal chieftain, I suppose, who we shall have to go to the trouble all over again of duping into being our son of a bitch, while hoping he hasn't noticed the unpleasant things that tend to happen to our sons of bitches when they become inconvenient to us. Let's also hope that the new big man has a name on the spelling of which we can come to some sort of agreement. Meanwhile, although we don't know who will follow Gaddafi, we do know who preceded him. It was King Idris, the first and only king of Libya. Idris was overthrown by Gaddafi in 1969 and spent the rest of his life in exile in Egypt. Though a tribal chieftain whose mind included very little manufactured later than the 12th century, Idris was a good friend of the West. Again, in fact, he was a better friend to us than we were to him. Idris was no fool either. He had, in fact, a sort of wisdom. Here is a reader's letter published in the London Financial Times back in March this year, after that newspaper had run a feature about King Idris. The letter is from someone named Tom Sebans at a London address. Here's the letter. Sir, in 1956, my grandfather, as the US Embassy's chargé d'affaires in Tripoli, had occasion to advise King Idris that an American consortium had discovered more oil. The king responded, quote, "I wish your people had discovered water. Water makes men work. Oil makes men dream." End quote. Since then, oil-financed dreamers have brought us ski slopes in the desert, unholy jihad, and criminal governments. The prescient philosopher king would not be surprised by today's turmoil in the Arab world. Too bad he's not here to suggest what we do about it. End of letter. King Idris of Libya died in 1983. Yet more here from MENA, this time from the ME end, the Middle East. The young Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was released on Tuesday after 5 years captivity in Gaza. The terrorist gang Hamas had kidnapped Shalit back in June 2006 on a raid into Israel. They'd held him ever since at an underground location, permitting him no contact with his family and no visits from international humanitarian organizations. Barbarians don't do humanitarianism. Israel finally got Shalit back in exchange for over 1,000 Arab terrorists, convicted in Israeli courts, often of unspeakably horrible deeds. One of them, for example, name of Abdel Aziz Salehi, is a great hero among Arabs for having taken part in the murder of two Israelis who'd lost their way on the West Bank. Salehi was among a mob of Arabs who hacked the Israelis to death. He attained everlasting glory among his people by gleefully displaying his blood-stained hands to TV cameras. Also among these brave heroes of the Palestinian Arabs was Musab Hashlemon, who was actually released in a previous prisoner exchange back in 2004. 2 months later, he organized an attack on a bus. 17 Israelis were killed, the biggest group of them schoolchildren on their way home. The youngest victim was aged 3. These revolting psychopaths have been well fed and cared for in Israeli prisons, with educational programs and sporting events laid on for them, and regular visits from the Red Cross to make sure they were suffering no ill treatment. Gilad Shalit was kept in a hole in the ground, surrounded by booby traps in case Israel tried a rescue mission. He was fed a meagre diet and subjected to cruelties we've only heard about in hints from his family. All Western reports on the prisoner exchange noted the contrast between Shalit's thin, pale appearance and the robust look of the Arab prisoners. There you see quite starkly the difference between civilization and barbarism. Now, the released Arabs are free to blow up more buses and pizza parlours, and they will undoubtedly do so. They're also being greeted as heroes by their own people, and fawned over by their leaders. The loathsome Mahmoud Abbas, every mention of whom in the Western media comes with the epithet moderate, fawned over a batch released to the West Bank, calling them, quote, freedom fighters and holy warriors, end quote. That's what passes for moderation among barbarians. Israelis, of course, understand the pros and cons of the prisoner exchange. Some of them have protested the deal. Most, however, around 70% in polls, most of them approve. It helps that the deal was pushed through by Benjamin Netanyahu, whom no one ever called a faint-hearted appeaser. This was pure Nixon-to-China political strategy. A liberal-left prime minister could never have got away with it. Still, there is now a mighty incentive for Arab terrorists to kidnap more Israelis. And there are Israeli men, women and children walking around today who will be murdered next month or next year by the grinning fanatics who've been getting ticker tape parades from their enablers in Gaza and the West Bank. Moral of the story. When you've caught a terrorist and fairly tried and convicted him, take him out back of the courthouse and kill him. There is such a thing as being too damn civilized. Our administration announced this week that we shall be sending 100 military advisers, most from Army Special Forces, to help fight the Lord's Resistance Army in Central Africa. Who are the Lord's Resistance Army? Well, they seem to be a fanatical, ideological sect, a bit like the 19th century Taiping in China. Nobody has been able to figure out exactly what their ideology is, but as usual with these things, there are elements of religion, both perverted Christianity and indigenous magic, and millenarian utopianism. We do know who the Lord's resistance army is resisting. They are resisting the government of Uganda's President for Life, Yoweri Museveni, currently enjoying his 26th year in office. By way of doing so, they have committed numerous massacres, with Catholic congregations apparently being a favourite target. A favourite tactic is to descend on a church while it's full of worshippers, and then hack to death one portion of the congregation while carrying off the rest to be tortured, raped, or enslaved. The war nerd captured the essence of LRA tactics. Longish quote. The LRA is at war with the Ugandan army, but it's war Central Africa style. We're not talking Gettysburg or Verdun here. The idea isn't to have big battles, but to sneak up on an enemy village and kill all the civilians, take their livestock and steal their stuff. End quote. The main component of the LRA forces seems to be teenage boys, aged 13 to 16 mostly, leading one commentator to quip that, quote, "It takes a child to raise a village." Nasty stuff, to be sure. It's none of our business, though, unless you think that every bad thing happening in the world is our business, which I don't. I suppose a case could be made for the UN doing something or other, though if I were running the show, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot machete either. The Uganda adventure does illustrate an oft-remarked feature of liberal geostrategy, that military intervention is justifiable in inverse proportion to how much of our national interest is involved. And where whatever is going down is no skin off our national nose whatsoever, military intervention is absolutely imperative. I don't know, though. There may be other motives at work. Possibly Barack Obama wants East Africa to be safe enough that he can deport his welfare queen illegal immigrant aunt and his drunk-driving illegal immigrant uncle back there. Possibly. Be nice to think so. And yet another GOP candidate debate. The standard here was lower than previously, the candidates seeming less coherent and more snippy at each other. The impression I came away with, in fact, was the kind that you get from looking at one of the very cheap kinds of picture postcards, one where all the colours have been oversaturated, the reds too red and the blues too blue. The candidates all seemed to be caricatures of themselves. Mitt Romney was more than ever the teacher's pet, actually whining to the teacher a couple of times. Rick Perry reminded us more than ever that, for all its many virtues, Texas has an unattractive side. I can't express it better than paleoconservative Christopher Roach did when Perry's poll numbers started to dive. Long quote. Texas is a genial, wealthy, successful, and mostly capitalist state. It also has a long history of white coexistence with highly assimilated Mexicans. Starting 15 years or so ago, the state became completely inundated with Mexican coolie labourers. But the leadership of Texas, mostly white and Republican, doesn't mind this for a number of reasons. For starters, a great many rich Texans aspire not to work, but to play. They have gotten rich by having land in the right part of the ugly-as-sin Permian Basin. And these folks, not much liking hard work, have a very patrician attitude about Mexicans. They can't think of this demographic without thinking of their loyal and hard-working servants. They believe just a little magnanimity will make them all successful, assimilated, and inclined to vote Republican. the Mexicans' native political traditions and liberal-leaning domestic politics are completely ignored. Second, Texas's mostly white middle class, like the white middle class nationwide, is also finding manual labor increasingly distasteful, so they are happy to have armies of Mexicans to mow their lawns, clean their homes, etc. Since these workers are illegal, they don't make too much of a fuss, and they don't qualify for a great number of social welfare programs. It's not uncommon to hear Mexicans compared favorably to blacks, who are considered more dysfunctional and less hard-working as a group. Of course, the false dilemma ignores that Mexicans in America have higher social problems across the board, as represented by their epicenters in the Rio Grande Valley or East Los Angeles. Finally, because of the higher rates of assimilation of earlier generations of Texans of Mexican descent, particularly in El Paso and San Antonio, the leadership is sanguine about the prospects of assimilating the latest batch. Facts don't count. While there are some signs of unease among the working class, and even among assimilated Hispanics, these people are not part of the power structure of the place. Plus, money coming out of the ground, as it does in Texas, tends to make everyone happy enough with their lot. End of long quote. I can't say I agree with every word of that, but I think the writer is broadly correct in implying that if you like the side of Texas that Rick Perry represents, you must love Brazil. Herman Cain, too, was an exaggerated version of himself. From his previous appearances as genial but not very well informed, he went here to being over-genial and dismally ill-informed. Not Herb's best performance. The 999 thing is a campaign gambit. Nobody, even I'm sure Herb, thinks anything like it would get past Congress. Still, it's not actually a bad idea, as can be seen from the way that liberals are scoffing at it. It deserves a better defence than Herb gave it on Tuesday. Rick Santorum likewise went from being preachy and annoying to being super preachy and as annoying as that yappy dog two doors away. He told us about his daughter's surgery and actually addressed her. All good luck to the kiddie, but this stuff is no more appropriate to a presidential candidacy than Herman Cain's bowel cancer. If Newt Gingrich has an ingrown toenail, I sympathise, but I really don't want to hear about it. Newt, in the spirit of the thing, was super Newt. He was super smart, super reasonable, and supercilious. His contempt for that portion of humanity that is not Newt Gingrich was well concealed, but not as well as usual. Ron Paul displayed full Ronness, brilliant conservative radicalism, plus off-the-wall nuttiness. Michelle Bachmann was at her best, and for my money she came out the winner in this show. She got some criticism for mentioning Obama's aunt and uncle, but I was glad to see someone bring this up. We should enforce the law, even for people related to the president. And then Mitt Romney again. I was at a gathering of conservative types a couple of days later, where someone asked, "Hands up those who would vote for Mitt Romney in the general, but reluctantly." Well nigh every hand went up. This was followed by several people expressing the hope that underneath the bland, smiling, open-hearted Mitt that we see, there is a subtle, devious, ruthless and cunning Mitt well hidden. I share this hope. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item, this weekend the world population will pass the 7 billion mark, headed upward. Is that too many, too few, or just right? Nobody knows, and there are cogent arguments on all sides. Only one thing is mathematically certain, and that is that our planet has some maximum capacity to support human life. What you think that capacity is depends on your own personality and outlook. American conservatives, especially religious ones, are mostly philoprogenitive, while liberals and some irreligious conservatives, contrarywise, favour fewer people. As always in a fact-free zone, people go with their inclinations and cook up arguments to support them. The really interesting numbers are comparative. Fertility rates in the zone of barbarism compared with those in the zone of civilization. Or fertility rates of the very religious when compared with those of the irreligious or casually religious. The subject of a book by Eric Kaufman, which I reviewed last year. See my website, johndarbyshire.com, under Reviews. I'd like to give you an opinion about that 7 billion number, but I honestly don't have one. I read an article about peak oil, or the depletion of fish stocks in the ocean, and I think to myself, uh-oh. Then I take a cross-country flight, and I look down at the emptiness of vast stretches of this country, which is one of the most populous in the world, and I think a billion or two more would fit in just fine. It probably comes down at last to technology, and what new ways we can come up with to provide ourselves with food and energy. Anyway, the 7 billion is here, a tripling of the world's population in my own modest lifetime. Item, the Occupy Wall Street movement survived another week, nobody apparently willing to heed my calls for fire hoses, tear gas, and helicopters dumping disinfectant on the campsites. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of a passionate intensity. Meanwhile, a report came out from the Census Bureau saying that Washington, D.C. is now the nation's richest municipality, having surpassed the Silicon Valley town of San Jose. In fairness to the government people, I should point out that much of the D.C. wealth goes not to the federal government worker bees, but to the lawyers and lobbyists who feed off Leviathan. I proposed on the corner, in fact, that conservatives march on Washington and occupy K Street. But nobody heeded that call either. People told me they couldn't afford to take the time off work. Item, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, a welcome home party for a resident just released from juvenile detention ended in an unsightly fracas. Gunshots were reported, and 5 people were treated for stab wounds. Such a shame to spoil a happy event like that. Although I should note that on the upside, the young guest of honour was not among the wounded. Several bloggers retailed this story under the headline, Shanks for the Memories. But of course, we here at Radio Derb would never stoop so low. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Apologies for the somewhat truncated quality of the broadcast. I have to rush off to a party for one of my staff members, recently returned to us after a long absence, about which the less said the better. There will, at any rate, I assure you, be no disorder. We do these things properly in the Empire State. A tea dance, cucumber sandwiches, and homemade lemonade for the kiddies. You Quakers down there in Pennsylvania, listen and learn.